Hello, and welcome to the November edition of Volunteer Voices, the members-only podcast of the American Association for Museum Volunteers. I am Richard Harker, the Vice President of AAMV, and I am joined by my co-host Anna Frew, the Manager of Volunteer Services at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Hey, Anna.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I am doing really well. Happy to be here with you. And just so everybody knows, Volunteer Voices is one of a number of new initiatives that the board of AAMV is working on this year to provide stellar new members-only content for all of the good folk out there who join AAMV to network with others in the museum volunteer management community and learn about and talk about best practices. In these conversations we're having on the podcast, we're going to be talking to volunteer managers, interns, volunteers, and all sorts of special guests. But if you're listening to us today, then that means that you are a member of AAMV, so thank you for your support. You should check out our new website, aamv.org, and access all of our new members-only content there. And then the last piece of news, before we jump into today's conversation, is that in the spirit of audience evaluation, we want to hear your feedback. So please email us at rharker@kennesaw.edu, or come to our website and let us know what you think about our podcast, what topics you want us to cover, and generally what you think about AAMV. We're always open to new ideas and comments and feedback. So, with all of that said, let's turn to today's fantastic guest, the president of AAMV herself and the manager of volunteer services at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University in Philadelphia, Lois Kuder. Hey, Lois, how are you today?
Good. Nice to be here with you.
Well, happy to have you with us. And what we thought we would do is ask you a little bit about, like, your real-world job at the Academy of Natural Sciences, as well as your time with AAMV on the board as the president. And so if that sounds good with you, we're just going to ask some questions and have a conversation.
Fine with me.
How did you first come to be involved with AAMV?
Well, I inherited AAMV from my predecessor here at the Academy of Natural Sciences, who had been a member, so it was sort of there when I started my job back in 1990, and it was interesting stuff, a great newsletter, so I just maintained the membership. I joined the board in 2001 as the Mid-Atlantic Regional Representative, and was sort of nominated by a colleague here in Philadelphia who had been active with AAMV. So that's when I got onto the board.
And what's your favorite thing about being the president of AAMV? And how long have you been the president? And tell us how all of that came about.
Ooh, the president. How long have I been the president? I'm not sure. I basically took over from our previous president Jin Wachter, who needed to resign because she was very much engaged in docent management, the docent council. And I think it was probably about 8-9 years ago that I took on the presidency. And it's a responsibility. It's kind of scary, but it's rewarding, too, because I have the chance to work with lots of great people on the board and to see the organization grow and change.
You know, what would you say has been your best memory of your time with AAMV thus far?
Best times. I really enjoy working with the board members. So the best times have been when we've had a chance to do face-to-face board meetings, usually at the American Alliance of Museums meetings, and getting to know people and to really learn from them, because it's a really interesting group of people that all come from different perspectives and with different ideas and new ideas and things that I never would have thought of. So just kind of being able to get together with people, but also the first webinar that I was involved in was pretty amazing because I was totally unfamiliar with webinars, so it was quite an experience and really enjoyable and lots of fun.
What about the webinars? And I know that you've moderated a number of webinars subsequently. What about the webinars really appeal to you?
Well, it's really freewheeling. It moves very fast. There's ideas that fly by. The people that participate in the webinar, not just those presenting, but the audience out there are kind of on another plane and exchanging ideas, and it's a very vibrant exchange of information that just kind of flies by. So it's a lot of fun that way because it's really fast-paced. And we do have a webinar coming up January 25th on evaluating volunteers. So this is part of a series that we've been doing, which have all been pretty successful, and we've been working with the American Alliance of Museums on this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Can you tell us, like, if somebody were interested in joining that webinar, just how they would go about doing that?
They would need to log on to the American Alliance of Museums website, which is AAM-US.org. I hope I have that correct. Chime in if I don't.
No, I think that's right. And also, and for AAMV members, there's also a discount code. If they email one of us, we can email them the discount code for their registration as well. And that's one of the perks of being a member of AAMV.
And there's also the opportunity to do these for free if you host, I think it's called Watch and Talk event, where you invite your colleagues in the area to come and watch the webinar together. It's a little different experience, but it also, AAM has promoted this so that people get together and talk and extend their conversation after a webinar and before the webinar and work with colleagues on that. And I've done two of those, I think, and they've been a lot of fun, too. And it's been an opportunity to get together with folks in the local area and within your own museum, too.
So how does that work on the day? Do you sort of participate in the webinar and then afterwards just have a conversation?
Yeah, it's like a meeting. You set up you watch the webinar together, and then people stay afterwards and discuss it just informally, or you can have set up questions or whatever you want to do. But you just kind of hang out together and do that, which we do in Philadelphia. There's a very strong network of museum volunteer managers, and we get together a couple times a year already. So there's already a network here. So it's been really easy to set up the watch and talk events.
And what advice would you give someone if they were sort of thinking about setting up one of those watch and talk events?
It's probably good to check with folks in your own museum, see if they're interested in participating, and other colleagues within a reasonable travel distance. I know this can be much more challenging if you're out in a rural area. Obviously, it's much different than being in a big city where there's lots of museums. So you kind of need to test the waters first to see if anybody's interested before you sign up with the American Alliance of Museums and have just you there by yourself. So it may or may not work depending upon demographics and the community that you have around you. But it might be good just to try to build a network around you too is another kind of thing that I know a lot of people do in urban areas. They have informal meetings with their colleagues from time to time and just brainstorm ideas. And this is sort of the webinar attached to that with a little more of a program focus to it.
Great. So actually, to segue into that a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about your quote-unquote normal job?
Normal? No volunteer management job is normal, which is what makes it fun, and it's always challenging. I've been here at the Academy for, 26 years now, and it always changes. There's always new things to do, things that you could do better, different volunteers, because it's a lot of rotation in and out of the volunteer corps. It's not a group that stays 20 years, so there's a lot of new people always starting. My main role is to kind of funnel volunteers into the museum to help them with information and the application process. Once they start, they work directly with staff who train and supervise them. And my other part of the job is to be a funnel for the staff who want to engage volunteers or unpaid interns. And we are also working now with a co-op program at Drexel University. So I'm in charge of helping staff line that up, too. So I'm working from both ends, where I work with the staff to make sure they understand the process and what to do and are professional about it, and also working with volunteers to help them find a match. At any given time, we have about 300 volunteers active here, so it's a pretty big group of people, and half of those are new each year. So it's quite a diverse group.
And... I know we, I'm shocked. It's such a big group. I know we want to talk about your team program a little bit, but there was something you said that I was interested, sort of, what kind of work do you do with your staff to sort of prepare them for working with volunteers?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's one of those weak elements that we wish we could do. Training staff to work with volunteers is kind of one of those dream things that some people are successful in doing. I have not been here. We count on our staff to already be good at this, and most of them are. Those that choose to work with volunteers really enjoy it and understand that this is a teaching opportunity, that they're engaging people who are coming because they want to learn new things. So they create that type of an experience for them, whether it's an intern, obviously, and or a volunteer. So the staff are already pretty good at this. I give them guidelines in terms of the process, mostly the paperwork, that sort of thing that they need to do to get somebody up and running. So my role is to kind of ease them through that required system of paperwork. And the training and supervision, yeah, if there are disasters, we can help staff say, hey, you know, let's do it this way. But most of them are really excellent at this already. I'm very fortunate to have a museum where people get it. They understand what volunteers can do and what you need to do to maintain them and keep them happy. So that part of my job has been pretty easy.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. And the fact that half of your volunteer corps is new every year, it sounds like a lot of work. But can we talk a little bit about the team program that you work with?
Yeah, we use a lot, probably a third of our volunteers, if not more, certainly in the summertime, are teens, as young as 14. And they do what the adults do. It's not a special team program for them. They come and do whatever volunteers do. We do also have a special team program called Women in Natural Sciences, which I don't really have a role in. That's a whole different staff that operate that. And that's for high school women. That started in 1982. And it's for high school women who apply and are interested in science as a career and get a lot of after-school programming and special trips and all sorts of things that really build them to pursue a career in science of some kind. But that's a whole other thing, and that's really a great program here where we engage, you know, 40 to 60 teens at any given time throughout their high school life. But the regular volunteers come from everywhere and anywhere, and they're just kids that are interested in science or always wanted to be a paleontologist since they were 3 years old. So it's a group that's highly motivated, and they really do, they step up and they do what adults do out on the floor of the museum, primarily on the floor of the museum, sometimes behind the scenes working in the collections, curatorial work, but more the fun jobs are really out on the floor working with the public.
So do those young people get kind of additional training from the staff because they're younger, or are they just kind of given the same training as everybody else?
It's pretty much the same as everybody else. Most of our training is on the job. In our dinosaur area, we do have a series of classes that gives them a lot of content. But in other areas, it's hands-on, on-the-job learning. They don't so much get more or different training than adults, but they get more supervision. And that's the key with teams, is you really got to, they need supervision. They need feedback. They need attention. But the staff that work the most successfully with teens understand that and provide that attention just to make sure they stay on the straight and narrow path and, you know, are comfortable using information. With teens, sometimes the social skills are where they are lacking a little bit. We don't screen for knowledge, for grades, or anything like that. We don't care what grades a kid is getting in school. We'll take them if they're excited and want to do it. And we will, you know, give them the content information they need, and they take a little bit and run with it and then build on it. Talking to people is sometimes a skill that a teen might not have a lot of experience in. How would you if you're 14? So that's where they need practice and tips and some poking. So that's where the having supervisors that are really working on site directly with teens is important. You just can't kind of turn them loose and out in the hallway and say, hey, go do that, and not watch them because they really need feedback, and they turn into kids if you don't watch them. They turn into teenagers instead of the adults that you want them to be. So the supervision is the key, I think, with teens, and giving them feedback, positive and negative when needed.
And how do you recruit teens, Lois?
We don't need to recruit them. They find us.
Really?
We can't take all of them who apply. I mean, it's a popular museum, natural science museum. It's easy to recruit adults, too, because it's something that everybody likes, nature and dinosaurs and animals. So it's pretty easy for people to do that. Our website is the main conduit through which people find us. They are looking for something, and then they'll contact us via our website or a volunteer match we use a lot, too. Schools, kids who need community service will find us because their school is aware of us, and they'll contact us. We work with some special school programs where kids will be released for part of their school day to work with us. And those are relationships we've cultivated in areas where that works really well. And we take homeschoolers, too, which are often great because they're available on weekdays when it is hard to fill schedules. But we don't need to look for teens. Plenty of them are eager to work here and in other museums, too. They just need to know you exist.
Wow. I imagine that word of mouth would also be a big part of recruiting.
Yeah. Yeah, friends of friends, people, teens who talk about their experience as a good one, and their friends do that. That's probably almost any possibility in terms of how they find us. That's one of them, certainly, not the most major. It's often teens that are just interested in science, and they want to do something related to that, career exploration.
That makes sense. Do you have any sort of liability waivers or anything that you do or that you need to do with your teen volunteers or just your volunteers in general?
Yeah, do we ever. Now that we're recently, since 2011, we've been part of Drexel University, which is a major university and has a fleet of lawyers and HR people. So they've really tightened up what liability issues doesn't include background checks, and now all volunteers who work with minors, those that are out on the floor of the museum, are required to do background checks, and Pennsylvania has its own procedures and regulations for that, and we do it because it's important to do. We also have paperwork to process new volunteers that are forms that have been recently developed by Drexel University to ensure that volunteers and unpaid interns know what they're going to be doing here, that they're not accepting some position and have just a vague idea of what it's going to require. So job descriptions, which we always had, have been, reviewed by the Drexel human relations people and approved as being appropriate and legal in the case of unpaid interns. This also includes a parental consent form that basically is to make sure that the parent knows that the child's going to be working here, and basically to clear Drexel University and our museum from any lawsuits if something were to happen to a volunteer. So volunteers sign off on all sorts of things so that if they die on the job here, we're not liable in any way. The risk is really minimal, but it's all about, again, liability issues and legal things that could happen if something goes wrong. So it's good stuff to do. It's a pain in the neck for volunteers because they find it intrusive, and often the questions asked are, beyond what you really need, and they're not always happy giving up their social security number to a big university that's beyond our museum. So it's been a little bit tricky to introduce this, but most people understand why you do it and that it's important to do, and are willing to slog through it. We lost a few volunteers that just absolutely refused, but that is what it is.
Yeah, I think going forward it's probably going to be easier just because it's an established policy for you. But yeah, I think now it's very common, I think, for museums to do that.
Well, and Lois, I had when working with teens, do you ever have to deal with sort of parents in sort of intervening or getting involved?
Well, you do sometimes. You do have parents that are a little bit. Parents can get in the way of teens in terms of scheduling, because parents sometimes plan things for teens, and the teen doesn't know. They're already signed up to come, and then suddenly can't come because their family has other plans for them. So that can be an issue in terms of, a parent getting in the way of a teen fulfilling their obligations. But generally not. We have some parents who, particularly in the application process, seem to fill out the application for their teens. But generally, you handle things like that at the interview level, where you really find out what that person's all about, and the parent's not there. So it's a small problem. And we haven't had parents who are totally unhappy with the experience their kids have had here, because the kids have a great experience. They learn all sorts of stuff, and they really develop skills, as they would in any museum. It's a good opportunity. Communication skills in particular, talking to people of all ages and backgrounds, even adults need to learn how to do that. So even when a teen starts out pretty rough in terms of being really timid and not too good about talking with people, with time and practice, they get really good at it, and they turn out to be really outstanding in many cases. And adults, too, same thing. It's not that different. Adults aren't necessarily better communicators.
So it sounds like, you feel like working with teens is really not so different and maybe not as scary as maybe some people might think it is.
No, it's not scary, but you do have to have staff that really like teens and their goofiness and their sometimes immaturity and are willing to, again, give them good supervision. But you need to have a setup where you have staff out on the floor, at least within eyesight of your teens, or adults, too. We find that our adults really want that close interaction with staff, because they learn all sorts of new things each time they come just by having a conversation with that expert, that educator or scientist. So they really expect that attention, too, and that's what keeps them coming. So that direct supervision is really important, again, off in an isolation booth or out on the floor of the museum with nobody in sight around to kind of be with you. Is a model that is harder, and we learned the hard way when we did kind of turn teens loose in our hallways with sort of a touch cart without giving them enough supervision, that then they talk to each other and look at their cell phones and do all the things that you don't want them to do. So you need to really keep training them. But again, we've had as many problems with adults who, do stupid things and act unprofessionally. So it's all about training, good training, and supervision, and screening to begin with, so that you don't get people that just aren't really enthusiastic about being there. Teens who are doing it only because they're required to do 20 hours of community service are not usually a great match. They have to also really, really, really want to be there beyond their 20 hours. And that's important, too. So the whole application process is really strong, and then following up by giving people good training and attention, supervision. It's just a question of providing a friendly presence for them so they want to come back. Not different from any other museum experience.
Yeah, one more question for you, speaking of volunteer experiences. Richard had started on our first episode, he wanted to include a question where he asked what your favorite volunteer experience was. And so, Lois, I'm asking you this. Can you share maybe one of your favorite volunteer experiences?
Me as a volunteer or with my volunteers?
With your volunteers.
With my volunteers. One thing that I've really enjoyed doing with volunteers is we've started a photo gallery of them, and in our newsletter we collect profiles and photos and post them. And having them up, it's really helped me to learn actually who's who so that I remember I can match a face with a name. But it's also been a nice project for volunteers to kind of be recognized. They sort of are proud that you are interested enough in them to take their photo and to do a little profile of them. So that's been a really nice project to do. And it's helped me get to know volunteers a little better, because once they start working with their staff person, I sometimes never see them for months at a time. I don't necessarily interact directly with them. So it's been a project to kind of get me more engaged in face-to-face interaction with the volunteers.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
I love that. That's awesome.
It's an easy project. You don't need a big you don't need any budget for it, actually.
even better, right?
You just need a bulletin board, and that may be an issue.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Lois, for everything today. And thank you all for joining us for our inaugural, our second Volunteer Voices podcast. We want to thank all of the board of AAMV, especially Lois, for your incredible hard work as volunteers to the board. And also, we want to thank you all for your membership with AAMV and for supporting us. And like I said, check out our website for all of the new initiatives that we have coming up.
For Anna Frew, I'm Richard Harker. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.